So today we will start studying the quantum fluctuations of a Klein-Gordon field on an expanding space-time. Remember what our strategy here is. We assume that the system starts out in a state that we assume to be the vacuum state at some time eta naught. We still have to make this explicit in an explicit model. But for now, let's just say at time eta naught, at an initial time eta naught, the system starts out in the vacuum state, what is then the vacuum state. And because we are working in the Heisenberg picture, it's always going to be in that state, even if later on that state is no longer the vacuum state. The system, anyway, is always in the same state in the Hilbert space because of the Heisenberg picture. Then the strategy is to solve the quantum field theory using this chi field, which is the scale factor multiplying the physical field phi. Remember that the chi field is expected to grow much faster and to much larger amplitudes than the physical field phi because it's multiplied with the scale factor of the universe. And if, for example, this grows exponentially, then this will be exponentially larger in amplitude than the physical field. Or vice versa, if we find that this has a very large amplitude, well, we still have to divide it by this exponential factor to get the physical field. So now the chi field is expanded in this way using A and A dagger operators and mode functions. Remember, the mode functions solve the Klein-Gordon equation for the chi field, and they also obey a Wronskian condition in order to ensure that the canonical commutation relations hold. Of course, we will choose the mode functions in such a way that the corresponding A and A dagger operators are such that this A operator annihilates the vacuum state. We don't have to, but it's very convenient to do so. So we will arrange that we choose that mode function to work with, such that the A annihilates what is the vacuum state at the initial time eta naught, which might be a time just before the universe starts to expand. So there are several technical challenges. In particular, we need to identify which state that is. And of course, we will either use the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion, which is what will then tell us what the mode functions have to be, because it will provide initial conditions for the mode function. Or we may also be a bit lazy and just assume that before the universe started its big expansion, it was basically Minkowski space. Because in Minkowski space, we can tell right away, too, what the mode function is and what the vacuum state is. So that would mean that the mode function is initially the mode function of Minkowski space. But then, as the Klein-Gordon equation becomes non-trivial, the solution will evolve away from its usual form on Minkowski space and become a non-trivial-looking solution then. So by proceeding in this way, we have the benefit that the vacuum state is known by construction from the beginning. And we then know what the operators phi hat of k and eta are, because we express them explicitly in terms of mode functions and A and A dagger operators. So solving the Klein-Gordon equation gives us this field at all times. And once we know that, I mean, initially we calculate the chi field, but then we just multiply it or divide it by the scale factor, we get the phi field. And once we have that, then we can also work out what the canonically conjugate field is. And therefore, we can then calculate all predictions at all times, because we have the canonically conjugate pair of variables at all times explicitly. And in particular, once we've done that, we can calculate at all times what the fluctuation spectrum is. Remember that definition from last time. There are two ways to interpret this. This quantity, which is k to the power of 3/2, and then the mode function's value divided by the scale factor, modulus of it, this quantity can be interpreted either as the two-point correlation function that gives us the amount of correlation between quantum fluctuations of the field here and there, if the distance between them is the distance which is 1 or 2 pi divided by k. Right? K was the co-moving mode momentum, and 2 pi divided by k gives us the co-moving distance between two points. And if we multiply co-moving distance with the scale factor, we get the proper distance. So on one hand, we can view this quantity as giving us the amount of correlation between the quantum fluctuations at two neighboring points, and the distance between them is set by k, or more precisely by 2 pi divided by k. Another interpretation of that same quantity is that we take a box of size 2 pi divided by k times 2 pi divided by k times 2 pi divided by k, or a ball of the corresponding radius, and we average the field over that region. Remember, that's what we called the region. We denoted such a region with the letter B, capital B. So we take a region in space of a certain size, 2 pi over k, and then we average the field over that. And then we calculate what the expectation value of the field is averaged in space over that. It's 0. But then we can calculate what is the standard deviation around 0. And that was that number here. By the way, whichever way you interpret that, as the two-point function or as the average, as the size of the fluctuations of a smeared field, smeared over some region B, these things are observable. For example, in the cosmic microwave background, you can also measure two-point correlators. And you can measure the average size of fluctuations of the temperature in this patch, and that patch, and that patch, and so on. So this is very close to observations. Now what we see here is that this quantity that is really the desired quantity, that's the thing that we want to calculate. We want to know how big are the quantum fluctuations of the field, either interpreted as a correlator or as the standard deviations of the fluctuations of a smeared field. This is the prediction that we are after. And we see that it is calculated in terms of some decorative factors, like 1 over the scale factor and k to the power 3/2 times the mode function, where this is the mode function of the chi field. If we divide it by A, we get the mode function of the physical field phi. So what we've achieved in the previous lecture by deriving this equation, what we achieved there is that we found a way to calculate the prediction for the size of quantum fluctuations from calculating the size or the magnitude of the mode function later on. So you see, in principle, we have now everything lined up. For example, the universe could start out in a Minkowski space scenario. So we know what the mode function is at early times. And then the universe expands. That means that the Klein-Gordon equation looks non-trivial now. This means that our initial mode function evolves quite non-trivially once we get into the regime, into the time period where the universe is expanding. And then we get some non-trivial looking mode function. And if we then want to know, well, OK, now that all of this expansion has taken place, what's the size of the quantum fluctuations? Easy. Just calculate that expression, and you get the quantum fluctuations there. But there's more to it. And today, we will get into some of those details. In particular, let's ask, under which circumstances is Vk large? Or under which circumstances is Vk divided by the scale factor large? In which circumstances do we have large fluctuations? When the answer is, and we talked about this earlier, the most efficient mechanism to make the mode function large is to turn the Klein-Gordon equation into an equation for a harmonic oscillator whose potential is upside down. See, our Klein-Gordon equation for the chi field looks like this. The second time derivative of chi, remember primes denote differentiation with respect to conformal time. Dot was differentiation with respect to proper time. So the second time derivative plus omega k squared times the chi field is equal to zero. And this is normally, in Minkowski space, it would be a positive quantity. But it can go negative. And therefore, instead of having an ordinary harmonic oscillator for every k, we then have an inverted harmonic oscillator for every k. It would look like this. It would be as if we had quantum mechanics of a particle whose potential looks like that. And in that case, the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation looks very different. I mean, initially, before this turns negative, we know how the solutions look like. In Minkowski space, for example, where this is a constant, we know how the solutions look like. There is basically a right oscillating solution and a left oscillating solution. All the solutions are of the form e to the power of I omega t, or e to the power minus omega t, or linear combinations of the two, such that you can get, for example, the cosine of omega t or the sine of omega t. But when this omega squared can go negative, then instead of having e to the power of I omega t and e to the minus I omega t, you don't get the I. So you just get e to the omega t or e to the minus omega t, which means that you get one solution that grows without bound exponentially, another one that decays exponentially. So when can that happen? When does it happen that this thing goes negative? Well, let's remember what it was. Omega k of eta is the square root of k squared plus m squared a squared minus this term. Let's see. In Minkowski space, the scale factor is just constant, just 1, which means that this term is gone anyway because it has a time derivative. That term is just 1, and then we have the usual so-called dispersion relation. The dispersion relation is the name for the equation that relates the frequency of a wave to its wavelength. Then we have the usual dispersion relation that the frequency is the square root of k squared, the wave factor squared, plus m squared, as usual. If you square, you just get that energy squared is equal to momentum squared plus energy squared minus momentum squared is mass squared, right? But what we see here is that on the expanding space-time, the mass term is multiplied with the scale factor, and we get this new factor here. The mass term, it turns out, will not matter in cosmology, so we will drop that term, and then the crucial dynamics is between those two terms. This one that's always positive and this one that's always negative. And the physics is very different depending on which one of the two dominates in this discriminant.
Why do we neglect the mass term?
We will later see that the mass term contributes to the overall dynamics of the universe. So it contributes to the classical part, but it doesn't contribute to the quantum fluctuations. Okay, let me anticipate a little bit how these things will go. The Klein-Gordon field will be decomposed into a constant part, the so-called zero mode, which is not depending on space at all, only on time. And that part will be described classically. And then the quantum fluctuations around it that create the inhomogeneities, they will be treated quantum mechanically. And the dynamics and the mass term will be in the dynamics of that constant part, but it will drop out of the dynamics of the fluctuations part. So here's the difference that the sign makes. If we are looking at an ordinary quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator, here's the position variable, here's the potential upwards. Then if the potential is a parabola like this, then the ground state wave function is simply this Gaussian, and that's stable. If the particle is in this state, it will stay in that state. However, if we now, this might be a mode, a wave vector k, at early times when everything is still in order, everything is just like in Minkowski space. And then imagine the universe expands very dramatically, and the second term, the negative term, wins over in the discriminant, so that the omega squared becomes negative. In this case, over time, we have that this potential flattens out, becomes like this. And now what will happen with the Gaussian? Well, the Gaussian will flow apart. And it will become a wave function that looks like this, and very fast. So it will flatten out very fast, and the probability for the particle to find close to zero will drop dramatically fast. And it will become very likely to find the particle very far away. I'm talking here first quantized quantum mechanics, just an ordinary harmonic oscillator. Of course, we will do it for a field and a mode oscillator, but just thinking of an ordinary harmonic oscillator, that is what will happen. So the uncertainty in the location of the quantum mechanical particle is well confined by the Gaussian initially. But as soon as we have that this spreads out, we have that the uncertainty in the value of our quantum variable x here, and it will be chi later on for the field, or phi, will be very large very quickly. So these are runaway solutions then. So it would seem that it's super dramatic if the universe expands at a rapid enough pace. In fact, what is important here, as we will see, is not really the speed with which it is expanding. No, what matters is the acceleration with which it is expanding. And if the acceleration is strong enough, that will happen. And it would seem, therefore, that the chi field will have a very rapidly increasing value of its mode function, and therefore of the quantum fluctuations. But there we have to remember the caveat that this is the dynamics of the chi field. And the chi field is not the same as the physical field phi. The chi field is just some convenient variable. In order to get the physical field phi, we have to divide by the scale factor. And what we will see is that, generically, the spread of the wave function will be exponential. So the quantum fluctuations of the chi field grow exponentially. But they have to be divided by the scale factor a of t, which also grows exponentially. So that what we will find is that the physical field chi does not actually diverge exponentially. Its uncertainty, its quantum fluctuations, will be just frozen in that process. And if you remember, the differential equation for the physical field phi included a friction term. It had a term that was first order in time. And that's why we moved into the chi field, so that we get into a more familiar territory of quantum mechanics without friction. But now we see how the friction comes up. It's that the chi field blows up, but it's divided by the scale factor A, so that in total, it will not blow up. And in the picture of the phi field directly, it means that it just grinds to a halt. The friction dominates. Now, before we do more about the quantum fluctuations of the field, it may be worth looking into the particle picture again for this process. So let's assume that, as we said, at time eta zero, the quantum field started out in the vacuum state, or started out in what was then the vacuum state. And then, and that was still Minkowski space. And then the universe expanded in a more or less dramatic way. Then, let's assume that after a while, that wild period ends, and at time eta 1, as the time eta 1 is reached, the evolution becomes adiabatic. So it might still be expanding or shrinking, but not in a dramatic particle-creating way, but just adiabatically. That's a useful assumption because it means we know how to identify the vacuum state then. Because whenever the evolution is adiabatic, we can identify the vacuum state using the adiabatic vacuum identification criteria, which was the vacuum state is that state which is subject to the least particle creation during an adiabatic phase. So that means that at the later time eta 1, when all of the expansion has settled down and everything is evolving adiabatically, or maybe it's even Minkowski space again, but in any case, at the very least, it's evolving adiabatically, then we can identify the vacuum state again. We can identify, we can find out which vector in the Hilbert space it is now that describes the vacuum. And then we can find that mode function whose associated A and A dagger operator are such that the A operator annihilates what is now the vacuum state. So what that means is that we are operating now with two different mode functions. We describe the same field, chi, either using a mode function and A and A dagger operators, which are such that the A operator is annihilating the state that was the vacuum very early on. Or, alternatively, we use another mode function, which is chosen such, the thing with the tilde, that the A tilde operator happens to annihilate that Hilbert space vector, which is the vacuum state later, at time eta 1. And of course, there's going to be a Bogoliubov transformation between the tilded and the untilded quantities. There are two basic possibilities now. So we said we start out with a quiet period where the universe is either in Minkowski space, is either Minkowski space or it is adiabatically evolving. In any case, we know what the vacuum state is. Then there's a period in which all sorts of things might happen. And then we say there's another adiabatic period later on at time eta 1. And there are two basic circumstances now, depending on what happened in between eta 0 and eta 1. It could be that nothing special happened. It could be that the evolution was adiabatic. The universe might have expanded or shrunk or both, but adiabatically. Or, and that's the alternative possibility, it was not adiabatic and wild things happened. Either it expanded very quickly or super quickly and we have that the harmonic oscillators of the modes do this, or maybe they even flipped around for a while. Either way, let us distinguish the two cases. First case is that nothing special happened between eta 0 and eta 1. It was all just adiabatic, slow change of omega k. And the other possibility is it was not adiabatic for whatever reason. Either the omega k was just time dependent with a too fast time dependence, or it actually flipped. Let's see what the consequences are of either case. Let's start with a case where between eta 0 and eta 1, the universe evolved somehow, but adiabatically. So that's case 1. The evolution of the mode k was adiabatic from eta 0 to eta 1. Oh, I should remind you that whenever we say that the evolution of the universe is slow or fast, is adiabatic or non-adiabatic, we have to qualify that statement by telling which mode we are talking about. See, each mode corresponds to a wave vector k. And a wave vector k corresponds to some physical wavelength p. To some physical wave vector p. And it has a certain oscillation frequency, omega. Omega k or omega p. And when we say that the universe is expanding fast or slow, then what we mean is the universe is expanding quickly or slowly relative to the mode in question's own frequency. So if, for example, just to give you an idea of how robust the notion of adiabaticity is, let's take the light in this room. Let's say we take light in the middle of the spectrum, green light. It has perhaps 500 nanometers or something in wavelength. The frequency of that is going to be, I don't know, 100 terahertz or whatever. It's just going to be a huge frequency, right? So it's going to oscillate gazillion times per second. Now, for a mode of visible green light, the criterion whether the universe is expanding adiabatically or not means, is the universe's size changing appreciably while we have one oscillation of green light? Right? It takes very, very short amount of time for a green light to undergo one oscillation. The universe is not going to do much in that time. Right? The expansion of the universe is not going to change much in the time period of one oscillation of green light, which means that the light that we see is completely in the adiabatic regime now. But the standard model of cosmology holds that at the very beginning of the universe, the expansion was dramatic. The acceleration was super fast. And the time scale on which things happened, at the time scale in which the size of the universe changed appreciably, the time scale was fast, even compared to the oscillation frequency of the waves that we are considering. Right? So this is what we are comparing here when we speak of adiabatic or non-adiabatic evolution. It really takes quite a bit of some action for the modes to be non-adiabatic. Just because, for example, electromagnetic fields of the kind that we usually see oscillate so enormously fast. But then remember too that if you follow, for example, a beam of light, let's say a laser beam of light that was emitted early on in the universe until today, its oscillation period has become longer. Because it started out, let's say, blue. Now it might be red or infrared and so on. Because of the expansion, the oscillation period gets longer and longer. And therefore, eventually, depending on how much the redshift has been yet, eventually, the mode may become non-adiabatic. So case one is the case where between time eta 0 and eta 1, everything evolved adiabatically. But what that means is that the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion will produce the same mode function at eta 0 as it does at eta 1. It will, in fact, give us the same vector at any time between eta 0 and eta 1. That's by assumption of adiabaticity. It will give us that solution which is the solution with the least particle creation. So if the evolution of the universe was slow enough, was slow compared to the frequency with which the mode in question, the mode k in question, is oscillating on its own, If that's what's happened between eta 0 and eta 1, well, then the vacuum adiabatic vacuum identification criterion points to the same mode function at all times, and therefore to the same vacuum state at all times, and therefore we don't have particle creation. But that shouldn't be surprising. We designed the definition of the adiabatic vacuum in exactly this way, namely so that adiabatic evolution doesn't produce particles. So therefore, the state of the system, let's call it omega, is zero at the beginning, but it's also zero tilde later on, because zero and zero tilde are the same vector. And therefore, there is no particle creation. It doesn't mean, though, that the quantum fluctuations have not changed. It could be that the quantum fluctuations changed. And how does that come about? Well, remember how the adiabatic solution looks like. The adiabatic solution is this. It's 1 over square root of omega k of eta times this integral here. And that integral only produces a phase for us here. And this solution, remember, that is the mode function that the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion points to at eta naught, at eta 1, and anywhere in between, if the evolution is adiabatic. It always points to this mode function. And then it doesn't mean, though, that the mode function's modulus is the same at eta 1 than it was at eta 0. Remember, the modulus of the mode function determines the size of the quantum fluctuations. But you see, the omega k of eta can change. In fact, it generally will. So in particular, if you take a one mode, let's say the mode k, at an early time, it described a mode with a short wavelength. At a later time, the same k, the same co-moving momentum k, describes a mode with a larger physical length, just because, you know, it's co-moving. So we are working here with co-moving momenta in a co-moving coordinate system. So every mode means a larger and larger actual physical wavelength over time. And we should expect that as the wavelength increases, the quantum fluctuations decrease. Because we know that from a previous study of the Minkowski space, that for long wavelength modes, the quantum fluctuations are small. And then for short wavelength modes, the quantum fluctuations are large. Now, let's look at the more interesting case two. And the case two is that the evolution was not always adiabatic between eta 0 and eta 1. But the harmonic oscillators of the modes might have gone like this, or they might have flipped over. Either way, because of non-adiabaticity, we will generically have that the mode function, whose associated A operator annihilates the vacuum at early time at eta 0, is not the same mode function as the one that whose associated A tilde operator annihilates what is the vacuum at later time. The vacuum identification criteria points to two different mode functions at two different times. Now, those two mode functions are both solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, to the same Klein-Gordon equation. And since the Klein-Gordon equation for every k has only a two complex dimensional solution space, it turns out that this mode function is a linear combination of that mode function and its complex conjugate, as we discussed earlier. So there's got to be a Bogoliubov transformation between the two. And vice versa, we can write the V mode function as a linear combination of the V tilde mode function and its complex conjugate. The reason being that the mode function and its complex conjugate span the Hilbert space of solutions. Why? Couldn't that be real? See, if that was a real valued function, then its complex conjugate would be itself. And then we have only one function. It cannot span a two-dimensional Hilbert space. But remember that it can't be real And that has to do with the Runciman condition. All right, so there must be coefficients, constants that relate this solution to that solution. So the vk of eta, that mode function, is a linear combination of the mode functions v tilde with these coefficients, these Bogoliubov coefficients alpha and beta. Now we expressed the size of the quantum fluctuations as a function of k. We expressed that in terms of the mode function v. Remember, it was what we had written earlier, just to remind you, didn't have the square here. We took the square root. And then it was just 1 over a instead of 1 over a squared. It wasn't k to the third. It was k to the power 3 half. And it was just v, right? We had k to the power 3 half and then the modulus of v divided by a. All right, so that's the equation that we had earlier. And it expressed the quantum fluctuations at a later time in terms of the mode function that we determined initially, right? That's the mode function that we get when we use the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion at the early time, eta zero. But now we know that we can express that mode function in terms of the mode function that describes the vacuum at later times. So let's express it in this way. We write that this is a to the minus 2, that we just carry that forward, the k to the third gets carried forward. And now we express the vk in terms of the v tilde and the v tilde star using the Bogoliubov transformation. We haven't calculated the a and the beta yet, the alphas and the betas yet, but we will later on. So what this means is that we can express the quantum fluctuations of the field, also in terms of the Bogoliubov coefficients, and the mode functions at a later time. For example, let's say the period of inflation has ended. Let's assume that we have, that's an over-idealization, but let's assume we have Minkowski space then. Well, if you have Minkowski space then we know what these v tildes are. Easy, right? We know what the mode functions are for Minkowski space. We know what the vacuum state is there. And then we can calculate what the quantum fluctuations of the field are just from these trivial mode functions of Minkowski space if we know how they are related to the original mode function. That is to say, if we know the coefficients alpha and beta. So, explicitly, let's assume that the non-adiabatic period is really over by time eta 1. So there was Minkowski space at before eta 0. Then between eta 0 and eta 1, we have just ordinary. And now we have a non-adiabatic evolution. And then after eta 1, we have ordinary Minkowski space again. Now, in this case, as we said, from time eta 1 onwards, we just have Minkowski space. And therefore, we have the usual Minkowski vacuum. And the mode function for the Minkowski vacuum is just this, if you remember. It was just e to the power of ei omega k eta divided by square root of omega k. That's the mode function then. We know that the a operator, or the a tilde operator, associated with this mode function annihilates that Hilbert space vector, which is the vacuum at time eta 1. So that means we can now express the quantum fluctuations of the field after all of the non-adiabaticity is over in this way. So we use the equation from above, and we just plug in what we know the v tilde to be. Right? Remember? Here the quantum fluctuations are expressed in terms of the original mode function v. Then we express it all in terms of the mode function later on, the v tilde. But we need the linear combination coefficients for that. We will have to find out how to calculate them. But for now, we just assume that we've done this. We've figured out which coefficients they are. And then, what these v tilde are, we because they're just the mode function of Minkowski space again. So what we now have is that the mode function, the fluctuation spectrum is given by the usual prefactor, and then these terms in which include the Bogoliubov alpha and beta coefficients, and this mixed term here. And because we are squaring stuff, we are squaring this thing here, right? So here we put the plane wave, here we put the complex conjugate of the plane wave, and then we just take the square of that, and we get these terms. And we get here an alpha k squared plus a beta k squared, and then minus this stuff. This has no time dependence. That has a time dependence. Now, we will neglect this term. Why? Well, on average, if you smear a little bit over time, this will average to zero. It's just an oscillation. It's just a constant frequency oscillation later on. Remember that at eta 1 and after eta 1, it's just Minkowski space again. And then we have a situation where this is oscillating very quickly. And so, you know, that's just like green light. It oscillates really, really, really quickly. So if we average over that, this term is going to average itself away. And the dominant contribution to the spectrum is given by these two terms. Then we can use the fact that the alpha k squared and the beta k squared obey that condition, which comes from the Wronskian condition, if you remember. Then what we can do is we can write the fluctuation spectrum now entirely in terms of beta, because that equation allows us to eliminate the alpha k. So if we do that, we have that the fluctuation spectrum is given by this prefactor times 1 plus twice beta k squared. Now, that expression we can analyze a little bit. There's some interpretation for that. First of all, if there was no non-adiabaticity, then there's no beta coefficient, right? Because remember how the Bogoliubov transformation looks like. Here it is, right? So if the evolution was adiabatic, V tilde is V. Therefore, alpha is 1 and beta is 0. So the larger the betas are, the more non-adiabatic was the evolution. So if we assume for a moment that the betas are 0, so the evolution was adiabatic all the way, then we obtain this expression here for the fluctuation spectrum. And this is exactly the term that we also had, except for the time dependence here and in there. It's exactly the spectrum that we also had for Minkowski space, if you remember. If a field also had a mass. The only thing that changes here is that the A factor takes into account that K means different lengths at different times. It means different proper lengths at different times, because K is a co-moving momentum rather than a physical proper momentum. All right, but beta can grow very large. And that's not a contradiction with anything, because the growth of beta isn't at the expense of alpha or anything like that, because the only condition that alphas and betas have to obey in order for the commutation relations to be OK, the Wronskian condition, after all, the only condition that they have to obey is that this is of basically the same order of magnitude as this one, so that the difference is 1. But they can grow a lot, and in particular, the beta can grow a lot. And we also know from earlier calculations that the expected number of created particles in the Bogoliubov transformation is given by the modulus of beta squared. And we did this calculation earlier. Now, the interesting thing, though, is that the equation F, let me show you where it is, this equation here, is particularly robust. It tells us what the size of the quantum fluctuations of a field are. And remember what that means. It means we smear over a region, and we look at the standard deviation of the smeared value, or we look at the two-point correlator. That is a property that is measurable about fields, fields and field amplitudes. And we can calculate that quantity in terms of the Bogoliubov alpha and beta coefficients, or in particular, the beta coefficients. Now, the beta coefficients, the beta k modulus squared, has the interpretation as the amount of particle production, as we calculated earlier. But remember that there can be situations where the concept of particle fails because the harmonic oscillator is upside down. So we can't actually speak of particle creation with eight Dagger operators applied to the zero vector. But even in the wildest of circumstances, this interpretation still holds. So we can always calculate those alpha and beta coefficients. And given the beta coefficients, we can calculate what the quantum fluctuations of the field are, no matter whether there is a particle interpretation or not. So in that sense, it is sometimes said that quantum fields are more fundamental than quantum particles. We can make predictions about the fluctuations of quantum fields even when we don't know what the notion of particle would be. Now let's translate things a little bit more, just to boil down that equation to something even more interpretable. Assume that capital L is a co-moving length. Then if I take the co-moving length and multiply with the scale factor, I get the proper length. Let's call that d. And similarly, we have a co-moving momentum. If we divide it by the length scale, by the scale factor of the universe, then we get the proper momentum. So then our relationship between the spectrum, of the quantum fluctuations and the beta coefficients becomes this relationship. So instead of expressing it as a function of k, which is a co-moving wave vector, we can express the fluctuation spectrum as a function of p, which is the proper wave vector. And then k to the third power is a to the third power, p to the third power. And down here as well, p squared times a squared is k squared. And we carry forward the m squared a squared. Then we get some cancellations here because we can pull an a out of this square root. Then we have a to the third in the denominator, a to the third in the numerator, and we just get this expression here, times 1 plus 2 beta. Now let us consider the case of everything having been adiabatic. If all the evolution was adiabatic, there are no beta coefficients, they are zero, and then we get that the spectrum, the fluctuation spectrum, is this, expressed in terms of the physical momentum, whose inverse is the actual physical proper wavelength, not the co-moving one. And you see that this is exactly the spectrum that we had calculated earlier for a field with a mass term. So what we see is that if the evolution is adiabatic, then we are really not affecting the fluctuation spectrum of a quantum field at all. The universe may be expanding, but at any point in time, we can measure how much do we have of long wavelength fluctuations, how much do we have of short wavelength fluctuations. You know, we measure the spectrum of fluctuations over the wavelength. Always the same. It's always that. But what we also see is that if there was non-adiabatic evolution between eta 0 and eta 1, it will have produced beta terms. And those beta terms affect the spectrum. So that means that even if we start with Minkowski space and we end with Minkowski space, these betas are left over and they will have an impact on what the quantum fluctuation spectrum is later when it's Minkowski space again. Okay, so I mean, it's not a surprise, right? We worked with the Heisenberg picture and the time evolution is in the operators, but we might as well have worked in the Schrödinger picture. And then it's simply the fact that in the Schrödinger picture, the vacuum state didn't evolve into the vacuum state because of non-adiabaticity, it evolved into some other state. And so obviously the fluctuation spectrum is going to be different too. All right, so all of the information about the fluctuation spectrum is going to sit in those beta coefficients. In other words, we just need one number per mode. For every k or every p, we need to know what is the coefficient beta, and then that tells us everything there. All right, so much to the about the generalities. Now, let's do this for the real deal. Let us look at specific cosmological models. So the standard model of cosmology holds that in the very early universe, and we're talking about like 10 to the minus 29, the first 10 to the minus 29 seconds or so, so really early. So the standard model holds that in this very early universe, the space-time underwent a short period of almost exponential expansion, a period of inflation. Let us idealize for now. We will have to loosen that restriction later on, but let's idealize for now and assume that the expansion was really exactly exponential. It cannot have been exponential there exactly, but as a first approximation to get used to what's happening, let's assume it was exactly exponential. And that means that the scale factor, A, as a function of proper time of a freely floating observer that has no peculiar velocity, the scale factor as a function of proper time of such a co-moving observer is e to the power of ht for all times. Now, that space-time doesn't have a big bang, right? Because you can go arbitrarily far back in time. The universe just shrinks. And you can go arbitrarily further to the future in time, and it will just grow and grow and grow. Right, and what that means too is that the universe will grow, and it will increase the speed with which it grows as well. But this h here, called the Hubble constant, is a constant in this model. Later, it will be a Hubble parameter. It will depend on time. But for now, let's just consider it to be constant in order to have this exponential model here. So the space-time that we obtain in this way is called de Sitter space-time. And I recommend that you read what Mukhanov summarizes about the classical physics of de Sitter space-time. So good to know. But it's just pure general relativity, so I don't want to spend too much time on that. But let us look at one feature of de Sitter space-time. That is to say, let us look at one feature, a very important feature, of an exponentially expanding space-time more closely. And that is its horizon. So we will consider the horizon for the Sitter space from two perspectives. There's a horizon for particles, but the horizon is also a horizon for waves. Let's first check what the horizon does for particles, and then let's calculate what it does for waves. So the first proposition is for particles. The proposition says that objects or two observers who are further apart than a proper distance of 1 divided by the Hubble constant, can never meet, cannot communicate. Okay, so what this says is that any observers that at some point in time, equal time according to this definition of time variable, any two observers who at equal time are further apart than 1 over h cannot communicate with each other and will never meet. Let's see why that is so. Let's consider an observer in a galaxy A, and let us choose the origin of the co-moving coordinate system to be where this observer is. So that could be, I don't know, at the middle of our galaxy. So that would be the origin of our coordinate system. Now let's say that at some arbitrary time ts, this observer sends a radio signal towards another galaxy B where some other observer B is sitting. And we want to see whether they communicate, whether they can communicate or not. See, there are two competing things at work. The radio signal travels at the speed of light. But the two galaxies are drifting apart. Not because they have motion, but because space is being created between them as the universe is expanding. So light is doing its best to reach galaxy B. But it could be that more space is being created between the galaxies per day than the light can cross in a day, in which case the light will never make it. Now, if the two observers are very close to each other, then not much space can be created between them. And therefore, the light will make it from one observer to the other. But if they're really far apart from each other, then there's a lot of time that can pass between the emission and the receipt of the radio signal, and there's a higher chance that it will never make it because more space is being created than being traveled through. So let's calculate that. Let's calculate what the critical distance is from which onwards they can no longer communicate. So the signal that A sends to B travels in a small amount of time, delta t, a small co-moving distance, delta x. Okay, so we're talking about a small co-moving distance, delta x. This means that because it's traveling at the speed of light, the scale factor multiplied with the co-moving distance is the proper distance, divided by the time, is equal to the speed of light. That's numerically 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. Okay, remember, scale factor times co-moving distance is proper distance divided by delta t, which is the proper time in that coordinate system. So a beam of light travels this far in that time. We will choose units such that c is equal to 1, and then we simply have that a times delta x divided by delta t is a inverse. Just by putting this a on the right-hand side. In the case of the De Sitter universe, which is of exponential growth, we have that the scale factor is e to the power of h times t, which means that 1 over the scale factor is e to the power of minus h times t. So we have now a differential equation for our trajectory of the beam of light, or the beam of radio waves that A is sending to B. The co-moving distance that the light is traveling per unit time is given by e to the power minus ht. We can solve that differential equation, of course, and we obtain that x of t, the co-moving distance, as a function of proper time, is given by minus 1 over h, e to the power minus ht, plus an integration constant. Now, let's fix the integration constant. We fix the integration constant c such that at the starting time, ts, the co-moving distance traveled by the radio beam is 0. So we must have that C is equal to this value so that at TS, the two just cancel each other. So the trajectory of the radio beam that A is sending to B is this one. Right? So at T equal to TS, that's just zero. And then as T grows, it becomes smaller, less and less gets subtracted from that, and you just get that. See, at T, as T goes to infinity, as you give the radio signal an infinite amount of time to travel, how far does it get? Well, what we see is that as T goes to infinity, that term goes away, as we just said, and that's the only term that's left over. And the co-moving distance traveled becomes just that, which is a finite value. No, that's TS, that's just a number, it's a starting time. So what we have is that if A sends out a radio signal, it will only ever cross a finite amount of co-moving distance. Of course, if you multiply that with the scale factor, you get a proper distance, and the light travels further and further and further, of course. The proper distance is unbounded. But the co-moving distance is finite. And what that means is that A cannot communicate with a galaxy B that has a co-moving distance from A, which is larger than that amount. The light will never arrive there, because more space is being created in between them. The space is being created at a larger rate than what light can cross. So the maximum co-moving distance that can be crossed by light in such a De Sitter universe is given by that value here. And we can calculate what the proper distance is between the galaxies A and B initially. So how far are the galaxies A and B initially allowed to be away from each other, such that a signal sent by A just makes it to B? So what's the proper distance between two galaxies at the launch time of the beam? Well, that distance is scale factor times the co-moving distance. And this was the co-moving distance. That is the scale factor. The two exponentials just cancel each other, and we end up with 1 over 8. So that's the horizon. Two galaxies that have that distance from each other can just communicate with each other. So you can't send a signal from one galaxy to the other. But if it was just a little bit further away, the signal would never make it. Right? So what we see here is that this coefficient in the exponential growth of the universe, this Hubble constant, this coefficient determines the size of the horizon. It determines how far you can see, literally see. Because galaxy A is not only sending radio signals on purpose. It's just, you know, its stars are sending light. And a galaxy B that's further away than that will never see any of that light. Not because it's dark. It's just because it just there's no time for the light to arrive. Now, if the universe is as over the past few years, measurements indicate, is really accelerating now, it means we have a horizon now, too. It's very big, like now, many billions of light years. But it should be there. There should be a horizon. And you can calculate it. I don't know what the number is by heart, but you now know how to calculate it. Just check out in the literature what the exponential factor is. To best knowledge, current approximation, you know, what kind of exponential growth of the universe do we have now? What's the growth factor? What's h now? What's the Hubble constant now? And then just take one over that. That gives you the horizon. See how far we can ever see if that's maintained, that acceleration. Which we don't know, because we don't know what's causing it in the first place. Also, notice that in this calculation that we just did, the starting time, the launch time of the beam, dropped out. It doesn't matter. And what that means is that the size of the horizon, 1 over h, is the same at all times. The horizon size doesn't change. That's not realistic. In the universe, the horizon size always changes. So, for example, if over time, the exponential growth was to level off a little bit, if it was to, you know, not be quite as large, the exponential, if h was a parameter that drops in time, for example, then the horizon would grow in time, right? You see, the faster the expansion is, the larger h is, the smaller is 1 over h, right? So the faster the accelerated expansion is, the smaller is the horizon. At the moment, the acceleration is just barely perceptible, but just barely measurable. We only found out about it a few years ago. Therefore, the horizon at present is huge. But in the early universe, during the period of inflation, h is thought to have been tremendous, so large, in fact, that the size of the horizon was tiny, like just a few orders of magnitude larger than the Planck length, maybe 5, maybe 6 orders of magnitude larger than the Planck length. So anything that was just, you know, a million Planck lengths apart from each other could no longer communicate. It means that in a hydrogen atom, the proton would not be able to communicate with an electron. In a nucleus, two neutrons could not communicate with each other. All right, so any two observers further apart than a proper distance of 1 over h cannot communicate. Right, okay. So the Sitter universe is a special case where we have a tremendous expansion and it's always the same in the sense that the size of the horizon doesn't change. In general, in inflation, whether it's the inflation today or the inflation at the beginning of the universe, we do not expect that h is really constant. The Sitter space is a very special case where h is constant. In a universe in which h is constant, we have a lot of symmetry. We have a time translation invariance because of it, because the horizon exists, but its size stays constant. It turns out that in the Sitter universe, you have as much symmetry as in Minkowski space. As many conservation laws, therefore, as in Minkowski space. Unfortunately, it's not realistic. The universe is not exactly the Sitter, never been. Okay, so we established what the Sitter universe is doing to particles, such as galaxies. Namely, this allows them to communicate if they are any further apart than 1 over h. Now, what about waves? After all, the notion of particle is sort of not as strong as the notion of field and its waves. So what does it mean for waves? How does the evolution of waves of wavelengths smaller than the horizon differ from the evolution of waves of wavelengths larger than the horizon? In fact, we can ask that question even for classical waves. It doesn't even have to be quantum waves. So the proposition here is that the Klein-Gordon modes oscillate while their proper wavelength is smaller than the horizon. Remember, 1 over h is the horizon. So the Klein-Gordon modes, the modes of a field, oscillate as usual as long as their wavelength is smaller than the horizon, but they stop oscillating. Even classical waves would stop oscillating when their wavelength starts to exceed the size of the horizon. This statement can be messed up a little bit if there's a large mass. But if we assume that the mass of the wave equation of the species in question is small compared to h, then that's exactly the statement. And we can assume that for inflation. Now, in order to see that this is true, in order to see that waves stop oscillating when their wavelength is larger than the horizon, let us work with conformal time. By the way, I think what would be really cool is to do an experiment in the lab where we try that out, where we have classical or preferably quantum waves, but let's say just classical waves. And we make it such that there's an analog of an expansion with a horizon. And then it would be nice to see that it actually stops oscillating. I mean, consider, for example, a rubber band. And then you can have oscillations in there. You can plug it like a guitar string, right? And then it will vibrate. It will oscillate, the rubber band. But unlike a guitar string, you can let loose on this rubber string, or you can pull on it. And what that does is that it mimics, in a way, a wave on the background of an expanding space-time. And so what I'm wondering is whether it is possible to cook up some mechanical analog, or perhaps quantum mechanical, where you have some physical system that mimics waves on an expanding medium, expanding at such a rate that the speed of sound in that medium, or the speed of waves in that medium, is such that the speed of propagation of waves on that medium is too small to allow communication still from one point of the medium to an arbitrary other point of the medium as soon as a certain distance is exceeded. Right? So I want a medium that we can stretch so fast that it basically has an acoustic horizon. And then see whether the waves freeze. Because that's what we are going to predict now. I've not heard of any experiment like that, but it would be nice to calculate one of those through. Maybe one of you can come up with an actual scenario where that could be done. Maybe a trampoline or something, and you suddenly stretch very fast or something like that.
It's tricky because it's the propagation speed when you pull on the edges.
Yeah, I don't know yet. And then maybe with a high-speed camera, and I don't know.
Like when you stretch something, the speed of waves isn't proportional to the tension or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. You're changing the parameters of it too, in a way that might not be mimicking exactly what we have here. But yeah, I mean, what we would need to compare is, you know, what the phase and group velocities are relative to, you know, the expansion rate there. I don't know. It would be great if that could be done. Because after all, it's super important for inflation. You could basically say you do cosmology in the lab if you could do it. At least the classical part of it. Okay, so instead of the waves oscillating, which would be done because of the solutions e to the power I omega t and the complex conjugate of that, which translates in the real situation to sine and cosine, you would have that these are just exponential growth and exponential decay. All right, so let's calculate this. We start with using all the mathematical tools that we had available, such as, in particular, conformal time. So the conformal time, if you remember, is the integral from 0 to t, 1 over a of t dt. And by the way, remember that we did an integral like that just a few slides above? You can actually interpret conformal time as the distance crossed, as the co-moving distance crossed by light. Up to a constant, an integration constant, conformal time is the co-moving distance crossed by light. Which also means that when the universe expands exponentially, since light can only cross a finite distance then because of the existence of a horizon, we should find that conformal time has an end. Future infinity should be at a finite point in conformal time, and we will find that too. Anyway, so the conformal time was defined through that integral up to an arbitrary integration constant, because you can always set your zero in your time axis wherever you want. So the conformal time is the integral, is the antiderivative of e to the power of minus ht, because, you know, that's just 1 over the scale factor. So therefore, conformal time is this, plus an integration constant. Now, as the time goes to minus infinity, as the time goes to minus infinity, what do we have? We have that eta goes to minus infinity as well. Because this thing blows up, right? If t goes to minus infinity, then that thing blows up, but there's a minus sign. So past infinity is minus infinity for the conformal time. But as t goes to plus infinity, as we go to future infinity, what does this thing do? Well, if you go to future infinity, then this thing goes to zero. Right? As t goes to infinity, that goes to zero. And we're just left with this integration constant here. Which means that in conformal time for the Sitter space, future infinity is reached at the finite value of conformal time. In principle, no surprise. Conformal time is the distance traveled by the co-moving distance traveled by light. And in an universe with a horizon such as the Sitter, this means it only gets that far. So if we choose C, the integration constant, to be zero, then we have that the conformal time is minus 1 over h, 1 over a of t. And we can solve that for a of t. And then we obtain that the scale factor is minus 1 over h eta. Right? So the scale factor of the universe is minus 1 over h eta. And as we saw earlier, now we see it confirmed. For the infinite past, eta is very negative. And that is a very small positive number. But as eta approaches a finite value, namely zero, this thing blows up to infinity. So in other words, conformal time runs from minus infinity to zero. Minus infinity is past infinity. And eta equals zero is future infinity. So the time axis has been squished on one side. All of what used to be future infinity, all of that is now at a finite time. It doesn't mean that the universe stops at some point. Right? The scale factor just blows up. And it's just a time, just a rescaling of the time variable, such that all of future infinity is reached at a finite value of the parameter eta. But keep that in mind, eta runs from minus infinity until zero. And then the scale factor is infinity, which is reached only in the infinite future. Also, it's no longer exponential. I mean, the scale factor grows exponentially, but we don't see that here. The scale factor grows exponentially in proper time, but it grows in this hyperbolic way in conformal time. Right. So now that we have conformal time, we can define our field chi by taking the physical field, multiplying with the scale factor, which is to say the chi field is the physical field multiplied by the scale factor, which is this, minus 1 over h eta. And now our chi field obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, as usual. But now the omega k can be made completely explicit. It's as usual, k squared plus m squared a squared minus a double prime over a, where a is given by minus 1 over h eta. So if you plug a equal minus 1 over h eta into here, a little calculation that I recommend as a little exercise shows you that the omega k is given by that equation here. So now it's explicit what this a double prime over a term is. It's just this. So now we see what is competing here. In order to make this positive or negative, in order to have this potential for the harmonic oscillator or that one, the question is whether this one dominates over these two terms. And when does it? Depends on k, obviously. Because you can always choose a k which is super large, no matter what that is, even if that's negative. If you choose a super large k, well, then it's going to be larger than that. So super large k means super large wave vector means super short wavelengths. So you can always choose super short wavelengths that are so short that they don't care about the horizon and so on. They are much shorter than the horizon.
But also, whatever k we choose, if we wait long enough for eta to grow?
Exactly, yes. Yes, that's right. So, that is right. No escape. Because all modes grow, and at some point, they outgrow the horizon. That's right. So, we have to check for imaginary frequencies. We are assuming that the mass is smaller than h. In fact, later in inflation, the mass will be zero. So that means that term is absent anyway, or in any case, this whole thing is negative, right? Because we are assuming that the mass is smaller than h. So this thing is smaller than 1, and therefore this whole thing is negative. So that thing on the right is negative. And as you observed, as eta goes smaller, which is towards the future. Remember, conformal time runs from minus infinity to zero. Zero is future infinity. So as eta runs from minus infinity towards zero, this thing blows up, and that thing blows up, and the whole thing blows up. It's negative, very strongly negative, and it will win eventually. So we have that at late enough times, at eta's close enough to zero, we have that this is definitely winning. But I'm already saying that this is when the wavelength starts to exceed the horizon. But I haven't proven it yet. Let's see why that is so, if that is really true. Maybe I'm lying to you all the time. So let's check it. So the claim is that for each mode k, there comes a time when omega k squared becomes negative. Now, the case in cosmology that is relevant is, as we said, the case where the mass is zero. So we'll just assume that for now. We will later come back to the reasons for that at a suitable point. So then, at what time is it that the flip of the sign happens? Well, this is assumed absent now. And the time when the sign of omega k flips is when this is of the same magnitude as that, right? So that is when this is the so-called horizon crossing time, eta subscript horizon of k. So the mode k, the mode with momentum, commutative momentum vector k, is said to cross the horizon when this is equal in magnitude to that. Which is to say that the critical conformal time eta is square root of minus square root of 2 over k. So our conclusion so far is this. A mode oscillates as long as the modulus of eta is larger than 1 over k. Let's just look at the critical condition here again. So that square root of 2 we will set equal to 1. So we work in the approximation with square root of 2 is equal to 1. The literature does it this way. I personally don't like it very much. But yeah. So a mode oscillates as long as the time is earlier than that critical time, right? But earlier means it's more negative, which means its modulus, its absolute value is larger. So as long as the eta, which is negative, is very negative, so it's early times, so the modulus is large, larger than 1 over k, as long as we have that, we have that it's still oscillating. Omega squared is positive. Now that condition can also be put this way, that we say that the modulus of eta times k is larger 1. Remember that condition, the product of eta and k. You know, just put that on this side. When the product of eta and k is larger than 1, that's the regime in which the wavelength is short compared to the horizon. It's the regime where the oscillations are still going on. On the other hand, if the conformal time eta is close to 0, so if it is late in the universe, if this is small compared to 1 over k, so this is small compared to it, it's beyond the threshold of the sign flip, that is when the product again of eta and k, when this product is smaller than 1, well, that's the interesting period. That's when the wave has a wavelength that's larger than the horizon. Let us express everything now in terms of proper wavelengths. So remember that eta is 1 over ha. You probably remember the other way around. A is equal to minus 1 over h, right? And they just moved this around and took the absolute value of it. So let us take this equation here, which describes the evolution of the scale factor, and multiply it with k, which is 2 pi divided by l. So then what do we have? Then we have eta times k on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side, we multiply with 2 pi over l. So we have 2 pi over l times times ha. All very innocent calculations. Then we transform to the proper wavelength. So remember that a co-moving wavelength, well, this was a co-moving momentum, this is co-moving wavelength. Co-moving wavelength multiplied with the scale factor is the actual proper wavelength, the actual physical wavelength that you would measure with a yardstick. Then what do we obtain? Well, if we plug that in here, so L is equal to lambda divided by A. So this is a lambda divided by A, so the A's cancel out, so we get this. So what we obtain is that this critical quantity here, I didn't mean critical in sense of a technical sense, this important quantity, eta times k, which if large means we are in the ordinary oscillation regime, if small it means that we are in the beyond horizon regime, this quantity can be written as 2 pi over h lambda. Therefore, finally, the two cases that we looked at below, namely saying that if this is large, we have oscillations. If, on the other hand, it is small, we don't have oscillations, means that this is large, meaning we have oscillation. We have oscillations means 2 pi divided by h lambda is larger than 1, which is to say that lambda is smaller than 1 over h, which is to say the wavelength is smaller than the horizon. Right? So what we see here is that that's the horizon size, that's the wavelength, that's the criterion that we obtain from this, that's the criterion for oscillations to occur naturally. So as long as the proper wavelength is smaller than the proper size of the horizon, 1 over h, we still have ordinary oscillations. But then, that's the other case, when the physical wavelength, the proper wavelength, is larger than the size of the horizon, then it's the other regime where the frequency has become imaginary and funny things happen. It's no longer oscillating. Now, these calculations are basically, you can do that for a classical field. So in principle, we should be able to see this behavior of whether it's the Klein-Gordon field or some other, I don't know, acoustic field or whatever. We should see that behavior. Maybe we can cook up something and perhaps do in an experiment or suggest an experiment where that would be visible. Maybe in a fluid, in a gas, or in some elastic solid. Extra points if you can if you can figure out an experiment for that. All right, that's it for today.